Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. As always, we begin by offering our most humble pranams at the lotus feet of our dear Swami. And we are in a very ebullient, happy and thrilled mood because this is a very, very special week, a week that comes only once a year, the week of the birthday of our dear Swami. And this year, Swami's birthday happens to be on a Sunday, and it is a global holiday almost, except for a few Middle Eastern countries maybe. So it is indeed a beautiful thing that we are celebrating our Lord's birthday on a day when we are free from all office tensions and work pressures. It's not as if such tensions and pressures worry us if Swami's birthday were to fall on a weekday, because I'm sure all of us just taken off to celebrate this day that we hold so close to our heart, so dear to our heart, because Swami is so dear to our heart. And at Radio Sai here, we too are celebrating Swami's birthday in our own little ways. And one such endeavor has been the release of 4 more new products, if we may call them so. We were just hearing to Nada Brahmam bhajans that were going on, and we are happy to announce that the 9th volume of Nada Brahmam is now on its way to the Prashant and Liam Sai Blossom store, and during the birthday season it will be released and it will be made available for all the devotees and all our listeners who have heard the Nada Brahmam. We want to thank you for your support, your encouragement, your feedback. If Nada Brahmam is what it is today, it is only because of Bhagwan's immense grace and love and your support and feedback. Along with Nada Brahmam, we are also having another album, an instrumental album. This is surely going to thrill each and every one of us, whether we hear to it in the car, in our offices, at our homes, anywhere. Soothing music is always welcome, and it calms down our jangled nerves, refreshes us better than a cup of coffee, and makes us feel Swami in the inner depths of our heart. That is the instrumental album. Apart from that, there are audio-visual treats waiting. The one massive project, if I may call it that way, has been a documentary on Bhagwan's visit to Shimla in the year 2010. It is massive in terms of the effort because it is being released simultaneously in 5 languages: English, Hindi, Telugu, Spanish and Russian, so that Bhagwan's devotees who are distributed worldwide can enjoy it in a language of their choice. It's a 1-hour documentary and it will really thrill you and enthrall you with scenes and sights you would never have imagined. That is a video documentary that is being released. And the final, last but not the least, is a musical video, which is the Leipzig Philharmonic Orchestra. The Leipzig Philharmonic is a very famous and well-known orchestra, and from Germany, and they had toured India in the year 2008, and they concluded their entire tour with a performance in the divine presence of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba at the Sai Kulwant Hall in Prashanthi Nilayam. It was a beautiful concert. Everyone who were present in the hall that day carried home memories of a lifetime, and especially the performers, they definitely carried memories of a lifetime. For most of them, it was the first time that they were seeing Swami, and what Swami did to them is something that has to be seen, to be understood and enjoyed. So the Leipzig Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra is another video offering from Radio Sai on the eve of Bhagwan's 89th birthday. So Prem, it is definitely a season of a lot of cheer, a lot of joy, a lot of prayer and a lot of hope.
Absolutely. Dear listeners, even as we're talking to you, what you hear in the background is that instrumental album which is being released. Maybe I'll just let you listen to it a couple of seconds. It's indeed amazing. I mean, that's the only word I can think of. It's beautiful. There's some magic, of course, in sitar and, of course, the flute. Unparalleled music instruments, indeed.
Yes. And dear listeners, so if you're happening to be by at Prashanthi Nilayam during the season, don't forget to pick up your copy. It is a purchase that you will definitely not regret. It is something that is going to fill your heart and soul with beauty and joy. Now that the good news, the announcements have been done, we come back and zero in on our topic proper. We had started something last week, which began with the question as to when my life is filled with so many activities, I have so many responsibilities towards my family, towards society. Apart from that, I have my office work, my professional life. In amidst all this, how am I to find time for spirituality, find time for God? Though I give a lot of importance to God and spirituality, that was the question with which we had started off. And the discussion last week evolved into three main divisions, if I may call it so. The first one, the first step is realizing the truth that the time that we allot to anything in our life is based on the priorities that we have in our life. And if anything is on top of our priority list, there is no way that we can spend time without allotting time for that. And if we are not able to find time for God, whether we like it or not, it has to be said on our face that apparently God and spirituality doesn't seem to be high in our priority list. And that is why we are not able to make time for it. Having realized that, we moved on to the truth that it's no use if we just allot time, allot say 1 hour, 2 hours a day or 1 or 2 days a week for God. It is not enough that we stop at allotting time. It has to be quality time. It's not just the quantity of time that matters, but also the quality of time. When we are spending time with Swami, are we really available for Swami? Or like we saw the example of Rani Rasamani and Ramakrishna Paramahamsa and a few other examples, where we are sitting apparently in the presence, in the divine presence, but our mind and our thoughts are elsewhere. So we started off by saying we have to allot some time for spirituality and God because it is top of our priority list. And then we moved on to say that it is not enough if we just allot a time. That time has to be quality time.
But we did one thing which is generally done in high school physics, you know. Whenever we want to come to a conclusion or we want to come to a derivation, we assume a lot of things. Mm. We say that, let's say that this is so-and-so, X is the value of X is so-and-so. Let's assume that there are no errors. Let's assume that there are no interferences. And that's a good way to come to a result. And I think precisely that's what we did. But we didn't answer one very important question, but maybe we'll start with that. We spoke of that, you don't give importance or you don't give time to God or spirituality if you don't, because you don't value it. Hmm. But we did not answer the question, why should we value spirituality or God? You know, what is the need for it? Somebody might say that I don't give priority because I don't see a need for giving priority.
Exactly. You know, towards the end of last week's discussion, we spoke about a professor's dream in which Swami showed him a mansion with different compartments, and just one compartment had been given to Swami, and we ended with possibly a rhetorical question on whether Swami should be made part of our life or Swami should be the center of our lives. So it appealed on an emotional front, but now when you bring in logic, yes, one indeed thinks, why should I make Swami the center of my life? Let's keep emotion aside. Why should I make spirituality or Swami the center of my life and not just a part of my life? Why indeed should I even make it a part of my life? Because in my life, I have to spend time, as I said earlier, on a professional front, on a family front, so many things to occupy my time, energy, and resources. Why should I allot something to spirituality? It is important that we answer this question before we go deeper into how do we actually find time for God and integrate spirituality with day-to-day life.
It's important, you know, there might be some people who are devotees who might say that this is a question which is not necessary for me, or an answer to this is redundant because I've already made my choices. Hmm. But many times when really serious life choices come before us, and you know, when we have to decide, especially when there is time and money to invest, and you're wondering which one to do, I think that's when a bit of reasoning or a bit of logically understanding why spirituality is important is very, very necessary. It's quite simple, you know. Whatever we do in life, what do we do it for? Let's say you're studying, you're earning money, you're getting married, you have a family. What do we do everything for?
Well, if you ask me that way, suppose I'm studying now, straight thinking I want to study so that I do well in my exams, and I do well in my exams, I get a good position in my class, which gives me a sense of fulfillment, which makes me happy. If you ask me why I'm getting married, it's because I feel straight away that my life will become happier if spent along with a person who shares so many things with me. I guess more or less anything that we do is because we feel that doing that will make our lives happier than what it currently stands at.
Exactly. I think it was an exercise we had done sometime back in the afternoon satsang itself, where we said if you ask about three or four whys, eventually the answer will be happiness.
Exactly.
You think that it's going to give you happiness. The person who is going after fame thinks that his happiness lies in fame. Or someone who is going out and doing seva, for that matter. You know, somebody is going and doing help to others. I think that is also because of that self-satisfaction which comes and which eventually leads to some happiness. So I think it's absolutely clear that it's not anything got to do with spirituality. The fact is, you do whatever you do for the sake of happiness, right?
Yes, and here's a question that pops in my mind. This is nothing special with humans, I feel. Don't you think, for example, a lion hunts because it's hungry and satisfying its hunger is what makes it happy? The same thing with any animal, I mean, whether a monkey jumping or a monkey plucking fruit. So it's almost looks like it's built into our systems to seek happiness.
Right, absolutely, but the only difference is, I think the happiness in animals comes only by following the senses and the impulses of the body. But I think only in the human being, even though eating gives happiness, there are some people who give up eating regularly and still can be happy.
Yes, I appreciate what you say, because we have seen at times, you know, recently I was reading about the Indian cricket team, and there is a stand-up comedian who has written about some of the people in the Indian cricket team who have impressed him. Okay. He writes about the current Indian captain, Virat Kohli, and he says Virat Kohli loves to eat food, but he has not had his favorite foods, which include non-vegetarian diet also, for the past 1 year. For the past five years, and he simply says that is something that will make me fat, which will affect my stamina, and which will affect my game. I would love to eat it, but I am keeping it for my post-retirement years. I am not going to touch it. So it was amazing how a person kept away from something that he loves just because he wants to perform better in, again, something else which he loves more. I get the difference you're saying. This is a kind of thing that, this is a kind of decision that only possibly a human being can do. Giving up food, for example, for the sake of better performance in sports. I don't think a dog will ever think that let me eat less because tomorrow I can jump 2 feet higher than the other dog. I agree to what you say that humans have this ability to give up smaller and lesser happinesses for what they perceive to be bigger and greater happinesses.
Absolutely. I remember one of our teachers telling us, you know, he lives a very frugal life. His room is one of the smallest in the hostel. When one of my classmates went and asked him, "Sir, what is the need for such, austere living? What are you going to get out of it?" So he said, "The kind of confidence that you have in your self-control is immense when you do such things. Because you know that your happiness does not depend on such and such things. You know, that gives you so much of self-satisfaction and confidence."
Wow.
So, you know, some of these things is because, you know, whether you're a worldly person, whether you're an ambitious man, or if you're a housewife, or if you're somebody who's a recluse who wants to have self-control, I think invariably all of us do it for a sense of self-satisfaction, which eventually leads to happiness. No, you want to be happy with yourself, right?
Yes, it's either that I want to do everything to get happiness, or I want to do anything in order to protect that happiness that I've got.
Exactly.
It's either one of these to get happiness or to maintain the existing happiness.
I think that's what all of us do, you know, when we invest, when we, save money. Because we are happy, you know, we have a good home, we have a good family, we are well taken care of. But we want to have that to continue. We want that to continue for some time. So we do future planning. You know, how do we ensure that this happiness is secured? So I think whatever we do is for happiness and to ensure that that happiness is eternal.
Hmm.
Right? So whether we accept it or not, whether we acknowledge it or not, I think all of us are after a constant and unhampered happiness.
Exactly. We are in the pursuit of happiness. And it is here, dear listeners, that spirituality actually comes in, because Swami posts, or Swami asks, Swami poses a very poignant question. He says, everyone is seeking happiness. Everyone wants happiness. But they seek it from things and objects that are temporary themselves. How can you get permanent happiness from something that is temporary? And that, in my personal opinion, is possibly the beginning of a spiritual quest. How can I get the happiness that I seek? Because not only do I seek happiness, as we discussed, we seek to protect the happiness so that it lasts as long as possible and possibly forever. Till I am alive, I want this happiness to last. That is what our endeavor is. So we seek happiness of a permanent kind, but we seek it from things that are impermanent. How do I get permanent happiness from things that are impermanent? If this question actually rankles us, that is possibly the beginning of a spiritual search.
And you know, whenever you read some of these spiritual books, like I think Living with the Himalayan Masters, which is a book by Swami Rama, or any of these Paul Brunton's books, where he talks of these different yogis who have attained different powers by, you know, certain austerities. There are some who never eat at all. There are some yogis who never sleep at all. You know, the kind of happiness that you get from this, you can say that it's a question of perspective. In a sense, like, if you just look at that, will I be happy if I don't eat? Of course I'll not be happy. Will I be happy if I'm asked not to sleep for a few years? Definitely I'll not be happy.
In fact, Prem, there is a scientific study that says you can possibly live without food for 10 to 20 days, but you can't live without sleep for more than a week. Your body will die. That's what this says.
But the very fact that somebody is saying that I can look at this situation and say that I can derive happiness even from this, I think it's the ability to see a larger picture, ability to see yourself more than what it appears. I think that's the difference between animals and men, you know, in many senses. Because you're able to see a bigger picture, and every other tool which we use, you know, in spirituality, let's say karma theory, or let's say the fact of you do good and good comes back to you, it is all an explanation of the confusions which come up when you see things in life.
Exactly. I was just reminded of a little, a kind of a email forward actually, but it is quite interesting, at the same time significant. You know, it says there are three things that you need in order to make your life happy, which is, they say the first is time. You need time to enjoy so that you are happy. You need energy and you need money. If these three are there, you are happy. But the irony of life is such that when you are young, you have lots of time, you have lots of energy, but you don't have money.
Right.
Even for a single rupee, you want to buy something, you have to ask your parents, you have to ask your elder brother, whatever, your uncles, your aunts, your grandparents, you don't have money. Then you graduate, you start earning your own money. That time you have lots of money, you have money, and as you grow in your career, you start earning more and more money, you have lots of money. And you have lots of energy, but now you don't have time, because whatever little time you have, it is spent in earning. And so that then you come to a stage in life where you have energy and money, but you don't have time. And finally you reach a stage where you retire, you've done all your life savings, there's a lot of money. And now, since you're not going for any professional job or anything, you have lots of time, but you have no more energy left because your body has grown old and there are so many things that you can't do what you would have done 20, 30 years ago. So therefore it looks like life is a cruel joke where it's assured that you're not going to get happiness in the pursuit of all these three. However, you know, this is like a generalization. There are many cases where, you know, possibly wealth is handed down to generations. And at a young age itself, people are rich. They have so much in terms of wealth and other endowment that they actually need not slog and work to earn their livelihood. So they seem to be having all the three, you know, money, time and energy. And that is when another factor comes in. This is an important factor because only humans are able to recognize this factor. Animals cannot. And, you know, that has in fact given birth to so many phenomenal philosophies. For example, Swami gives us the example of Alexander the Great, who died at a very young age, in his 30s, I guess. And in his 30s itself, he was the conqueror of the world. He had all the time, he had all the energy, he had all the resources because he had conquered the world. And yet, when he died, Swami says that he wanted two holes to be made in his coffin and his hand stretched out to show the world that I'm taking nothing with me. Death. Death is an enigma that strikes and gives rise to many of these philosophies because you feel that you may have the time, resource and energy, but death can strike at any time. And that fear of death is what drives people either mad or drives them to become spiritually enlightened souls. Like what happened to the Buddha, to Siddhartha who became the Buddha. So, in spite of having time, energy and money, there is this dagger of death that looms above you and you are absolutely unaware when it may fall on you, which again saps away your happiness. And there again, you know, when it comes to actually being able to enjoy the time, money and energy that you have without fearing death, there is no way to do that unless, once again, you turn spiritual.
Absolutely. I think, you know, most often that is the thing which happens, you know. Let's take science. One of the reasons why science has improved from 1900s to now, they say that it is kind of moved in a pace which is at least 50, 60 times what it was in the 18th century.
Hmm.
Or rather in the 19th century.
Hmm.
The only reason being the improvement in communication. Because what was discovered or invented in one part of the globe, the information of that could travel to the other part of the globe. So now, for once, a scientist was not on his own. Like, he was building on discoveries from different scientists, and he could progress from the knowledge which has already been acquired.
Exactly.
So same thing with spirituality. You know, if somebody comes and tells you that if you run after money, you're going to get nothing. And you might say, what do you know? You've not done it the right way. Let me run after it and find out. Or if you refuse to take the counsel coming from others who have achieved it, like, for instance, you said Alexander. You know, he must have really felt it that after conquering everything, he said, after all, there's no happiness in this. But if we refuse to take that counsel from a man who has achieved it and found that there's no happiness in it, then wouldn't we waste a lifetime actually going through that whole process? We might not achieve as much as Alexander did, but we will again come to the same conclusion at the end of it.
Exactly, Prem. And, you know, more or less this discussion is moving towards a point where we will state that in life, if one has to truly be happy, the quest has to be spiritual alone. Because there are so many examples of people who have achieved everything and yet achieved everything in terms of money, time and energy and resources and yet have not been happy. At the same time, there are so many examples of people who seem to have nothing and yet are happy. If we take the life of Gautam Buddha, as Prince Siddhartha, he had everything but happiness, but he didn't have happiness. As Gautam Buddha, he had happiness though he had nothing. So, it is apparently paradoxical. So, it almost comes to the point where we realize the truth behind Swami's statement that true happiness lies in union with God. Which now brings up another question. If spirituality alone is supposed to be our pursuit, because our sole pursuit in life appears to be the pursuit of happiness, and that happiness comes only from union with God. So putting equations A and B together, our only pursuit in life should be the pursuit of spirituality. So why on earth should you and I work at Radio Sai? Why on earth should we go to our offices? Why on earth should we drive the cars? Why on earth should we make pots or whatever it is that we are doing? Why should we be fathers? Why should we be mothers? Why can't all of... Does this mean that all of us need to become yogis and start spending all our time in spirituality? That is a question that arises.
I'm just reminded of what one of our old students shared in an interview which we had with him, Mr. Vijay Sai. He's been a lecturer in the Vrindavan campus. He is, I think, one of the students who has given a number of speeches in Swami's presence. Mm-hmm. Swami would call him very often and ask him to speak because he was a good singer too.
Mm-hmm.
One particular speech, he starts with a verse from the Bhaja Govindam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think, I don't know exactly what is it. That's a verse which goes, Suramandira Taru Moola Nivasa, which is about a recluse. You know, he's supposed to sleep in a temple. The ground should be his bed.
Mm.
He should wear the deer skin.
Mm.
And he should give up all other pleasures in life.
Mm.
You know, this was the verse he was quoting. The moment he started it, Swami looked at him and said, oh, what are you saying?
Mm.
And Swami stopped him and said, that is not my message. Okay, and he was surprised. And I think he would have almost told Swami that, Swami, it's not mine, it's Adi Shankara's. And Swami said, you know, this is not the message. My message is head in the forest, hands in the society.
Hmm.
And in fact, even now when we sing that Bhaja Govindam, the entire work of Adi Shankara, this particular paragraph is left out.
Aha, okay. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because we have often sung the Bhaja Govindam in Bhagwan's presence and I was not remembering the lines that you are quoting.
Yeah, even when we learn it without this. Because Swami says that this is for a particular sect of people who have taken up this as their path. But Swami says for majority of the people, especially for Swami's devotees and students, what Swami wants is, you know, your head should be after that wisdom and should achieve that wisdom, but that wisdom should express itself as your excellence in the work, in the field you're doing, your work in.
You know, Prem, when you say this, it reminds me of a very interesting episode that I read in another book, the kind of which you had mentioned. You spoke about Living with the Himalayan Masters by Swami Rama. Here I'm speaking about Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahamsa Yogananda. I think it is the 14th chapter in that book. It is termed as an experience in cosmic consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I am saying this because we started off with the question, how do I find time for spirituality when I'm engrossed in the world and my responsibilities? And our discussion led us to a point as to it is useless to do anything other than spiritual.
Right.
So the question now becomes, how do I find some time to do my worldly duties? If at all I'm supposed to do it. And from what you said, it is evident that we need to do our duties. So, I don't know if this episode will answer that question completely, but it is an interesting insight. Nevertheless, so here I mention it. It so happens that a little background is necessary for the story. It so happens that Paramahamsa Yogananda, who is then called Mukunda, by his master Sri Yukteswar Giri. So Mukunda decides that he is making no progress in the ashram where he stays with his master, because his master puts him on all menial tasks like growing vegetables and cleaning the ashram and things that far lesser mortals can do, in Mukunda's opinion. And so he decides that he wants to seriously pursue spirituality. And therefore one fine morning, without the slightest warning, he just runs away from the ashram in somewhere in West Bengal, it is near Calcutta. So he just runs away from the ashram and takes a train and runs to the Himalayas, because he feels that the Himalayas will grant him that spiritual knowledge that he is seeking.
Mm-hmm.
I will not go into his experience in the Himalayas, because they turned out to be real disappointment for him because he couldn't get anything at all. And finally, after a very harrowing experience, one of the Himalayan masters tell him that knowledge is not obtained from the mountain Himalayas, but in the Himalayan presence of your own master. So go back home. So months later, he returns back. And when he returns to his guru, he's expecting his guru to be angry, upset, whatever, because he has done without telling him. But the guru seems absolutely calm, not at all perturbed, and speaks to him so normally. So Mukunda says, Master, aren't you angry? Aren't you upset? Because I ran away and put you through great trouble, because I left so many duties unattended. And then the master says, why should I be angry? I do not want to exploit you by making you responsible for my expectations. I have no expectations at all. I just love you, and because I love you, whatever makes you happy makes me happy. It made you happy to run away from here, therefore I was happy. It makes you happy to come back here, therefore I am happy. Where is the question of being angry? That is when Mukunda's eyes filled with tears, and even as I read this, my eyes filled with tears, because, you know, anybody who reads will realize that this is how Swami's love has been for us. He has loved us simply because he loves us. And his love has always been to ensure that we are happy. And if at all he has appeared to be upset, it is only because he knows what we think is going to make us happy is actually not going to make us happy. So he wants to prevent us from doing something foolish. And that is why he has appeared upset or angry with us. So Mukunda is very, very, you know, taken aback with this kind of a response. He is overwhelmed and he gets back into his ashram duties. In the meanwhile, his guru has advised him that whenever he gets time, he should spend time in meditation. So one day, Mukunda is meditating in the ashram, and even as he is meditating, his master calls out, "Mukunda, Mukunda, come here." You know, just a few days before, he has had an experience of what his master's love is for him. And yet at this moment, he gets irritated. He says, "Master tells me to meditate, and now when I'm meditating, he is only spoiling my meditation." So he just shouts back, says, "Master, I'm meditating here." And the master tells, "Yeah, I know how you're meditating, like leaves that are being blown away in a tornado. So you just come down here." So he's exposed, because that is indeed his mental condition. You know, how can we fool our master? Because our master knows us better than ourselves. How can we fool Swami? He knows us better than ourselves. So that is how he is summoned to the master's presence. And then the master says, "You know, Papam, you have been going all around the Himalayas, everywhere, right? For this experience you have not been able to get only." So, you know, Mukunda is trying to come up with a retort, saying that, "Master, you know, if you just allow me to meditate, possibly maybe I can achieve that." Okay. Before he can speak, the master just hits him on his chest, just above his heart. And in an instant, Mukunda feels his breath withdrawn from his lungs. Mm. And then, in the autobiography of a yogi, it's a 2-page description. I don't think I can do it, because they say that the experience that comes is beyond words. And Mukunda himself has, I mean, Paramahamsa Yogananda Ji himself has attempted to put that experience in words. I'm reading those words secondhand and I'm producing it here. But nevertheless, he says that the air is withdrawn from his lungs. He no longer feels imprisoned by his body. He's able to see the cow on the street, the farthest building. He's able to see beyond the town, beyond the cities, and soon he's able to see the whole globe. And he realizes that the world is nothing but a speck in the universe. Then he sees multiple universes and he feels the entire universe within him. There is nothing to be fearful about because everything is him. There's nothing to expect because everything is him. And there is absolutely a feeling of pure unsullied joy because there exists nothing else but him because he is everything. And that experience lasts for possibly a few minutes. And as he is lost in the experience, it is a kind of addiction he does not want to return from at all. And suddenly, he feels the breath returning to his lungs, and again he feels like a bird being caged back. And he's in his body, and there he is. There is his master Yukteswar Giri with a gleam in his eye, with moist eyes, with eyes full of compassion, telling him that, no, you should not get too drunk in that bliss. There is a lot of work to do. Come, let us take the broom, sweep the ashram, and then go for a walk on the riverbed, on the banks of the river Ganga. And he says that now he realized that though in spirit one must always be one with that absolute truth that you are everything, at a bodily level, each body continues to do what it's supposed to do. And this was precisely the message that Yukteswar Giri gave to Mukunda, that you cannot forego your responsibilities and get drunk in that infinite bliss. That infinite bliss is there, you just have it and then continue to do all your tasks as you used to do. But this time it is different because you no longer expect anything from the task. Just doing the task itself brings joy, because whatever you do brings joy, because you are an embodiment of joy.
Absolutely. If you look at it this way, when you look at artists, people, musicians or instrumentalists, they would often say this, you know, their best music comes when they don't have an audience. And it's not necessarily a physical audience. Like even when they're sitting in front of an audience and playing, they say that, I think scientifically it's even called the alpha state. Mm. They say they reach a point where they are not, you know, they don't get the incentive from the response that comes from the audience, nor are they playing for anything. And that's the state when they actually hit their peak and the best music comes out. So it's almost like you do it for just for the sake of doing. And that would come when you, you know, when you are absolutely unattached. And anything which you talk of that kind of a state where you're unattached, where you don't want anything, you're selfless, you're talking of a spiritual state. You're talking of a state where you believe that, you know, your benefits are not worldly.
The only difference between the example that you now state and a yogi perhaps, or yeah, Swami, our own Swami, is that a musician, for example of a sitarist, needs his sitar to get into the alpha state. But Swami, when we take as our example, is always immersed in that alpha state, that what a sitar genius gets when he is playing the sitar only for himself, as you say, in solitude. It's not a physical audience, but it's about him doing it only for himself, for the satisfaction of the heart. That a master or a spiritually realized person is able to do, whether he is eating or drinking or just walking or talking, scolding, hitting, getting angry. And that is why they say that for a God realized person or for God, there's nothing like a bad karma. Because even while hitting, for example, when Lord Krishna sends the Sudarshana Chakra to kill, it is in that state, in that alpha state that we spoke about, it is not as if he has lost control of himself. It is not as if he has forgotten his reality and now he feels, I am this body that has to endure that other body, otherwise it is not good for everyone around. It is not that. It is not as if in that moment of anger, Lord Krishna has stepped down even to any extent from that state of universal oneness. It's always done in that state, and therefore there's nothing like a karma for the Lord or for the God realized one, because they are in that alpha state doing every activity, whether awake or asleep.
And I'm reminded of the life of one of the astounding Hindustani singers. I don't know if you heard her name, Kishori Amonkar.
I have not heard.
The life story is amazing. You know, she's in the top of her roost when she's supposed to be one of the best Hindustani singers ever.
Mm.
And people will do anything to listen to her. And if she starts a concert, she goes for hours together. And she actually goes through this very process, you know. She's a very popular, she's got the audience enthralled and all that.
Mm.
But she reaches a state where she says that I'm singing only for my God. Okay, and that makes her a kind of a little erratic person where suddenly she will say that today I don't feel like singing.
Mm.
And someday she will say that I feel like singing this for my God.
Mm.
So there's, you know, you lose that definability of that personality.
You can't schedule her for a program as such.
Right. So she says, I sing only for my Lord. But when she's in a peak of her career, the worst thing happens, she loses her voice completely.
Hmm.
And the beauty of the thing is, you know, that is when she realizes that she doesn't need her voice to actually sing for the Lord.
Hmm.
You know, when you said that a person who's a sitarist needs a sitar to feel that oneness with his music, she actually reaches that point where when she loses her voice, she realizes, oh, I actually don't need my voice to sing for my Lord.
Hmm.
So she said, now I can truly sing for the Lord. Like all this while, I was singing, the audience also enjoying, and I was saying that I'm singing it for the Lord. But now she said that I can truly sing for my Lord, and she did not undergo any treatment. She just went on like that for, I think, close to a decade without a voice.
Wow. You know, that is indeed a rare case, because I don't think that every musical maestro is
right.
able to achieve that state.
That's the beauty, you know. Even anything else you do in life, you don't need to be a musician or an artist of that sort. If you're doing anything, whatever it is, let's say you're a woodcutter, but if you start doing it with the feeling that I'm doing it for my Lord, I think you'll come to a state where whatever you do or whatever you are or whatever you, even the breath which you take, it'll be only for the Lord.
And when we say that we are doing it for the Lord, it has to be a genuine thing. See, only thing that matters in spirituality is fearlessness to have the courage to do. And the second thing is absolute brutal honesty. So when, I mean, it is not for anybody else's sake. If we are to derive the benefits, it is for our own sake. I need to be brutally honest with myself. If I say at the beginning of my speech that I dedicate this to Swami and whatever words I'm speaking are indeed Swami's words, I must definitely put in my 100% effort to ensure that I'm consciously, you know, keeping away without getting affected by the praise or blame that comes, because I must make effort to always keep in mind that it is Swami who is speaking. It is Swami who is speaking. If I just do lip service by saying it is Swami and then, you know, when somebody pats me on my back, my head swells in pride. They say it's a funny thing. You pat a person on his back and his head swells, they say. So, if that happens, it's of no use. So, when we say we are doing it for God, we have to genuinely, you know, if we are supposed to present something for Swami, it is not as if whatever was presented to Swami was the best from worldly standards. But it was always the best from the effort point of view. I mean, your best and my best may differ. If both of us are going to make a painting for Swami, the way you paint is going to be different from the way I paint. It is in terms of the end result. But the amount of effort, if you are given 100%, I too can give my 100% and I am equal in that. So when I say I am doing something for Swami, we have to give our 100% to that. And then only there will be joy in just doing it without expecting some kind of a result based on which we will get joy or we will get unhappiness. It is only when we are able to 100% do something for God that we will be able to enjoy whatever we are doing, and we are no longer dependent on the result for our joy.
I think exactly. I think this is what we started with. The ability to enjoy whatever you're doing. The ability to derive happiness from what you do and what you don't do. What you have and what you don't have. This is what we all are actually after, right? In life, we want that happiness which cannot be snatched away by anybody or anything. Any situation in life cannot take that happiness from you. And in the pursuit of this, you turn to God. In the pursuit of this, you turn to a spiritual life. You know, because you want some meaning in life. You want something which you want to hold on to, something which can give you an explanation to whatever is happening in your life.
And with that, Prem, we now arrive at a very, very kind of interesting point, because we started off by we want to do something to get happiness, and now we realize that irrespective of what we do, we need to be happy, and that we can only if we do for God, do for Swami, 100%. So we reach a state where, and you know, you made a very interesting point where you said, whatever we do and don't do. The don't do part is important. It is as important as the silence between the notes in a music piece,
right,
which determine the rhythm, which is very important. Not only are the notes important in the music piece, the silence between the notes also, which means if I am not doing anything also, that not doing anything also has to be for the Lord. That is only when I am able to do that, you know, doing everything for the Lord and not doing anything also for the Lord, it is only in such a state that I can be truly happy, because in such a state I am happy just being. I need not be a batsman, I need not be a father, I need not be a successful person, I need not be anything different in order to be happy. I just am happy. So if in order to derive true happiness, In order to derive true happiness, we have to be happy in just being. And that comes only in complete dedication to the Lord.
You know, when you feel like when you get a taste of that happiness, you know, you start going after it. And that's when this question comes that is it worth even doing things in the worldly sphere? Because once you've tasted that spiritual happiness, once you've tasted that happiness, which is much, much more than the best happiness you can see in the world, the question starts arising, what's the point in still doing things which is going to give me this lower happiness? Why not, you know, go after that ultimate happiness itself?
Exactly, Prem. And it is a very, very difficult question to resolve, because it's almost like we keep hearing that life is not about money, life is not about resources, life is not about just relationships, life is not this. There's something much higher about life. Spending life doing all this is like aeroplanes racing with each other on the ground. An aeroplane is meant to fly, you are meant to soar, you are meant to go higher. And here I am saying, now I'll just soar, I don't want to do anything with this. And now we say that, no, you can't, you know, it's, if the whole world becomes yogis, who will sustain the yogi? So what is it that actually we need to do so that we derive bliss and joy, and at the same time, you know, this conflict between allocating time and resources and energy to a spiritual life vis-a-vis to a worldly life is what keeps colliding. Because in the beginning we have a lot of time for worldly life, very little time for spirituality, and then we slowly realize the importance of spirituality, start giving more and more and more and more and more time. Suddenly it feels that the only way you can be truly happy is with union with God, and therefore all your time has to be spent in spirituality. Then come on, now the question becomes, okay, in leading my spiritual life, how do I find time for my worldly activities? Therefore I'll give up worldly activities. So as you rightly say, this is a kind of doubt, this is a kind of question that keeps cropping. And dear listeners, we have a very, very, very wonderful answer, an answer in the form of an experience of a very revered and senior college professor. That experience will be fantastic to listen. We will listen to it after this little break. So don't go anywhere. Be glued to your seats. This is an experience of a lifetime, and we will be lucky to hear it in the professor's own voice. He's a beautiful narrator, and therefore I'm sure all of us will enjoy this experience, and we will carry home a very, very, very important lesson on balancing spiritual life with worldly life.
But before we get to that experience, as Arvind said, we'll take a short song break, and it's after all the birthday week, isn't it? So let's listen to a beautiful birthday song for Swami, and don't go away, because at the other side of it will be that enlightening experience narrated by this teacher himself.
आज की रात निराली है, उसे मत पूछो। आज की बात निराली है, उसे मत पूछो। जिस तरह झूल रहे हैं मेरे सरकार यहाँ, दिल के झूले में बिठाओ व झूला कर देखो।
बोलिए इससे भी प्यार कोई रात आई है, मेरे बाबा की आज सालगिरह आई है।
एक महकी सी फिजा छाई है, जानते हो कि नहीं साल गिरह आई है। हर तरफ एक महकी सी फिजा छाई है, जानते हो कि नहीं साल गिरह आई है। दुनिया वालों सुनो,
दुनिया वालों सुनो,
दुनिया वालों सुनो, गिरह आई है, हर तरफ एक महकी सी फिजा छाई है, जानते हो कि नहीं साल गिरह आई है। सितारे भी मुस्कुराते हैं, आसमां पर ये नए रंग बिखर जाते हैं, चांद हंसता है सितारे भी मुस्कुराते हैं, आसमां पर ये नए रंग बिखर जाते हैं, भोर होते ही जो किरणों ने छुई चित्रावती, भोर होते ही जो किरणों ने छुई चित्रावती, एक मस्ती भरे संगीत में सब गाते हैं, एक मस्ती भरे संगीत में सब गाते हैं, लब पे कुदरत के छाई है, जानते हो कि नहीं साल गिरह आई है, हर तरफ एक महकी सी फिजा छाई है, जानते हो कि नहीं साल गिरह आई है। बर्बादी के आसार नजर आते हैं, जब भी दुनिया में कहर जुल्म सितम ढाते हैं और बर्बादी के आसार नजर आते हैं, तब कभी धर्म और ईमान की हिफाजत के लिए, तब कभी धर्म और ईमान की हिफाजत के लिए बंदा परवर खुद ही धरती पे उतर आते हैं, हर तरफ एक महकी सी फिजा छाई है, जानते हो कि नहीं साल गिरह आई है, हर तरफ एक महकी सी फिजा छाई है, जानते हो कि नहीं साल गिरह आई है, मेरे बाबा की आज साल गिरह आई है।
Isn't that a beautiful, beautiful song? I think it was recorded by some of the old students. A wonderful song indeed. So dear listeners, back to the topic. We're talking about balance of worldly life and spiritual life. I think there's no experience which we can think of which is a better explanation of this than that of our dear Bhagya sir. He's a lecturer of the Department of Management Studies in the university here. And it's a legendary experience because it's been handed down to us over generations, but we had the opportunity of listening to it right from him during one of our programs. He was a guest on our program Shravanam Mananam Niridhyasanam, where he narrated this entire incident. Of course, it was very apt for the series because that 1990 Samukho series which we were studying during that program was a very important landmark in this experience as such and in his life. So we listened to that experience of his, where, you know, Swami first gives him the taste of what you can get at the end of a spiritual journey. And when he thought that that is all that he has to go after, the correction which Swami did in his perspective, when he told him that, you know, what is important is that balance which is the essence of spirituality. So over now to Bhagya sir, we listen to that experience in his own voice. We are indeed sure that you will enjoy it.
One such thing happened, 1989. Mm-hmm. Because Swami had given me a task of inquiring who am I used to find out, what is that, who am I? I am Bhagya, but Bhagya is my name. I am so-and-so, I am an engineer, engineer is my profession. I am an Indian, Indian is the nationality. That, what is it? Swami used to repeatedly tell me, go within. And even the teachings of Ramana Maharshi, you have to find out, who am I? Who am I? What do I find? How do I? Should I put my head inside my chest like Hanuman? I should tear my chest and find out who am I? So it was very difficult. Now here I tell you one very, very significant day in my life. I can consider the happiest day in my life.
Mm-hmm.
In the evening after bhajans and programs, Swami had permitted us, the professors, to continue meditation inside the mandir.
Okay.
And Swami used to occasionally come out, but my job was to close my eyes and find out who am I. In, I think, somewhere in October 1989, Swamiji, once he was coming out with Colonel Jogara, if I recall, they wanted to discuss something and they wanted to go out. It was around 7:30 p.m. Now, I heard that Swamiji, very odd time, nobody was there in the ashram excepting me and one or two persons, those who were doing some work inside the mandir. So, I was in the veranda outside Swami's interview room and debating whether should I open my eyes or have his extra darshan or because he has given me the task of finding who am I should continue that. Otherwise, he will be, upset with me.
Mm.
But I said, okay, I'm trying to find him within. Well, let me open my eyes.
Mm.
I opened my eyes and saw him. He came, smiled at me and gave a nice, whack on my head.
Okay.
He went away. He took about half an hour to come back. I continued to inquire. Nothing happened. He came back. He didn't even look at me when he came back late in the night. Next day morning, that was the very special day for me. I came and sat after the morning darshan around 6:15, 6:30. I came and sat inside the bhajan hall. And again continuing with my the self-inquiry job which Bhagwan had given me.
Mm-hmm.
Moment I sat, I found mind straight got dissolved in something which I don't know, cannot say now. Then I found, hey, what is this? I was expanding myself.
Wow.
Not physically. I was seeing that very huge, like a transparent sphere around me.
Mm-hmm.
It's increasing indefinitely. And my body is small, insignificant dot in that I am. So it gave me a glimpse of, hey, now I know who am I. I'm unlimited. Everything is in me. And when I was looking around, at that time, Swami was going out to give a second round or maybe pre-bhajan darshan. Believe me, I saw even Swami as a small dot in me. And, hey, what's this? Everything is encompassed by me. With that feeling, I came out. I wanted to go to college to take the class. When I was walking on the path, roads, the buildings, the cars, the trees, everything is me. Nothing is moving. All, even I was walking, the small body is moving in me. I say, that's fantastic. I'm everything. Everything is in me. Then I sat, I don't know what happened, what would have, I would have taught these students. Honestly, I don't know. In the evening, I came back again for darshan with the same feeling. Went home, wife, food, house, everything, chairs, everything is part of me. Nothing is moving. I'm not moving. Everything is in me. So, evening when I came back, darshan time had sat, Swami came, looked at me, smiled, everything went away. It became normal. No, it became abnormal as I was. That was the yearning he gave me to find out who am I. It was that first experience, direct experience of who am I. When you are doing your duty with the full concentration, it's like mind not being allowed to go in future or brood over the past. When you are fully engaged, fully absorbed in the duty assigned to you, then as good as you are putting your car of a spiritual path, car on the spiritual path in a neutral gear. It is not wrong to take a pause. Mind remains neutral, pure. The two bad habits of mind are going in the past or thinking about future. So when you are fully absorbed in duty, which you know that Bhagavan has given, and it is for the benefit of the society, selfless service is as good as you are spending time in sadhana. That's why he has said that do your duty. Correct. You cannot escape.
Correct. Very beautiful, sir.
This reminds me,
yes,
when I joined in 1986, way back in 1990, it was 17th of June, it was a Sunday,
mm-hmm,
and Swami called all the teachers. It's a big story prior to that, but I don't want to narrate that. I thought, after these summer course discourses,
mm-hmm,
that I am wasting my time. Because one of the discourses, I don't know which number, discourse number,
mm-hmm,
Swami said, 24 hours, you should inquire, who am I? That is a sadhana. Because he had asked me personally also, don't waste your time. You think that you are a chemical engineer, forget about your chemistry and chemical engineering. So then and there, I decided that as soon as I go back from Vrindavan to Parthi, Swami concluded those discourses on 3rd of June 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back on 5th of June.
Mm.
The same day, I came and resigned from the job.
Oh.
Before resigning, I got a clue on 3rd of June itself, which was the last dining session with Bhagwan during that summer course. Bhagwan came to the kitchen and I was permitted as usual to do the video shooting of Bhagwan's movements. And in my mind, I said, Swamiji, you are told in the discourse that we are wasting our time. 24 hours I should do sadhana. So I will go resign, and if it is okay with you, give me the indication. Then this was an internal prayer to Bhagwan conversation, and Swami pretended that he is entering the dining hall where we were all supposed to sit and have a meal with Bhagwan during that summer course. Nobody was permitted excepting me, and Swami, of course, he goes before the boys are permitted. He went and saw every nook and corner of dining hall, and then he entered the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I got an opportunity. I said, Swamiji, if you really permit me to go and resign, give me namaskar.
Mm-hmm.
That was an internal understanding. Swami was going to the kitchen, and I put down my camera and I asked Swamiji, he said, what? He looked into my eyes. I said, Swamiji, can I take namaskar? He said, yes, take it. He lifted his robe and he gave me beautiful namaskar. So I knew that he has given him the permission to go and resign.
Mm-hmm.
I came back on 5th of June 1990, resigned, and my dean was shocked.
Mm-hmm.
To see, find that I don't want to continue. He said, what? What happened? Let Swamiji come back. Swami was still Vrindavan. Swamiji came back 11th of June back from Vrindavan. He said, let him come. I said, no, I have already got the signal from Bhagwan. So my meter starts. I have already resigned. Whatever the period you need for resignation, for approval of my resignation,
right.
It starts. Then after Swamiji came on 11th June, Swami talked to the registrar of the university and told him, see, semester has just begun and teachers are free, I'm free. Teachers are not asking me to talk to them.
Oh, Swami said this.
Prompted. So the message was conveyed to us that Swami wants to talk to us, but naturally we should pray to Bhagwan. So we did that, and I was not interested because Swami has given me the job of self-inquiry. So whether Swami talks to them or not, I'm not concerned. Can I go ahead with this story?
Please, please, sir.
Because it will take a few minutes more.
No, please, sir, please.
Right. Then on 16th of June, Swami sent a word to the teachers that tomorrow, 17th of June, which was Sunday, teachers will be free. They should sit in the front. But I continued to sit in my normal place. After Swami's darshan in the morning, I closed my eyes. I said, okay, whatever Swami wants to do. I didn't know even that teachers have been, because I thought I already resigned. Then Swami finished the darshan, came back, teachers were sitting in the front. He said, what? Why? Why are you people sitting here? Swami, please talk to us. Swami said, no classes today. No, Swami, today is Sunday. Swami said, okay, go. Then when I saw all the teachers were going in, you know, my mind played the tricks. He said, mind said that, see, although I've resigned, but my dean has not approved my, accepted my resignation, so I'm still part of the team. So I started walking towards the interview room. And I was the last person. Swami, you know, patted me on the back. He said, lazy, come in, get in. Believe me, I've seen, I've experienced maybe 65, 70 teachers and some of the research scholars in a small interview room, how they were fitted. I have witnessed and I can declare this, interview room expands when Swami calls so many people inside.
That's true.
But it was very difficult for even Swami to walk, cut across through the teachers and go and sit his usual chair inside the interview room. I was finding it convenient to just follow Swami. Then Swami sat on the chair. I had no place to sit. Swami got one of the teachers who was sitting next to Swami's chair. Donaputta, you get up and go and sit behind. And he made me sit just right at his lotus feet. Then he said, what are the questions you have? People were, you know, quiet. Then in my mind I said, Swami, what is sadhana? And I know Swami knows that I have resigned. And I have resigned for carrying out sadhana, nothing else. Then Swami looked at me, instead of me asking Swami, Swami asked me, what is sadhana? I did not answer because I wanted the answer from Bhagwan. So best way, when he puts a question, you keep quiet. Then Swami started a discourse. He said, sadhana, sadhana, sadhana. What is sadhana? True sadhana is unification of the sadhaka, the sadhyam, and sadhana. The goal of sadhana, the doer of sadhana, and the process of sadhana, they should unify. They should become one. Then, suddenly, Swami looked at me. Those eyes I cannot forget. Can I say in Hindi?
Please,
one sentence, sure. Swami said. Then I translate.
Yeah, sure.
Swami looked at me. He said, "E bhagya, kya sadhana karne ko chata hai?"
My God.
He said, "E bhagya, what sadhana you want to do?" He was furious, as if he's pouncing on me. So I made some serious mistakes, errors. I got hold of Swami's feet and I said, Swamiji, I do self-inquiry. And when I teach subjects connected with management courses, my mind gets diverted from Atma. So therefore, he did not allow me to complete sentence because he knew that I have resigned for this purpose. And therefore, he was furious to correct me. He said, listen, If you think that for sake of sadhana, you will give up the job, you are mistaken. If you divide that this work is worldly and this work is spiritual, even in 1,000 births, I will not give you what you want. I was shocked. I was trembling. I caught hold of Swami's feet. I said, Swamiji, please forgive me. What sin have I done? Because in my mind, being a professor of statistics at that time, I immediately calculated that 1,000 births, even if I take every birth as a human being, and on an average I live for 70 years, 70,000 years are over, but still he did not even give me guarantee that I will give you. On the contrary, he said, I will not give you. 70,000 years gone, and still I will not achieve what I want. I said, Swamiji, please enlighten me. What do I do? There he declared, true sadhana is sanctify your time. Sanctify your knowledge. Sanctify whatever you have. True sadhana is control of senses. True sadhana is helping others. See, I have brought all the students from the stage. They were Maharshi Tattvas. All the teachers and students have been Maharshis here. Students are ready to receive. Teachers are ready to give. Apart from your subject knowledge, you must share your experiences with them. The 70% of the discourse or the interview was from setting me right. Then he said, see Bhagya, through these students, I am going to cleanse the whole world. Yes. Then my mind, the thought came, Swami, some of the boys have, he did not allow me to dwell on that. He said, dekho, see, in a gunny bag of rice, there will be few grains, the translator translated as stones. Swamiji said, no, not stone. In a gunny bag of rice, there will be few grains of paddy.
Oh.
See, Bhagya, paddy is also basically rice. Remove the husk and it is rice. So, over the years, these students, when they were Maharishis, over the births, they might have accumulated some dust. It is your duty to remove that dust. You make them good. Set an example for them. Share your experiences of sadhana. Then they'll be happy. They'll be good. I will use them as instrument to cleanse the whole world. I have made you in charge of those students. What other sadhana you want to do? Make them good. It is his grace. Towards end, he said, make them good. Do what I tell you. Then I will give you what you want. Oh, Swami, you saved my 1,000 births, more than 1,000 births. Finally, you have told me that you will give me what I want.
Wow, that is so revealing. And actually, when we hear that, there is no need for any further elaboration. It becomes so very, very clear that we can't pit the world and spirituality against each other. We can't give excuse of the world for not doing spiritual things. We can't give the excuse of spirituality for not doing the worldly tasks. In fact, Swami says, you can't even separate things as worldly and spiritual. I think that is the most important point of this whole satsang, not only today, even the last week, that it is absolutely wrong to compartmentalize things as worldly and spiritual and try to balance them. In the wisdom that Swami has showered on us through Bhagyasar, he says that there is no need for a balance between the world and spirituality, because the world and spirituality are not two things. It is just one life that we have to lead.
Absolutely. You know, I'm always reminded of a very, you could say, a nonsensical story.
Okay.
It's about a man who is very poor. You know, he's a very, very poor man.
Mm-hmm.
He's not able to make ends meet. His children are starving and he's not dressed well and not well groomed. Mm-hmm. So one day in the marketplace, he meets a friend of his who is very sad about this plight of this man because he's unshaven and unkept and all that. So he asks him, what's the problem? Why are you like this? So the poor man explains that, you know, he's not been doing well financially and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So the friend tells him, no, I can't do much to help you, but I'll give you a piece of information.
Okay.
Maybe it'll be of use to you. So he says that I heard that on the other side of the river, in this particular range of mountains, there is a cave in which some king of the ancient times has left his treasure in one of the caves. So it's a legend and people talk of it as a rumor. But maybe you can look for it. And if you're lucky and if you find that treasure, you know, all your problems will be solved. So this poor man is very happy and he says, it's really a valuable information you've given me. And he says, I'm definitely going to go and look for it because there's no other time in my life I need it more. So this man goes away. Then about 3 or 4 months later, again these two meet in the same marketplace. But this poor man is still the same. You know, he's still having an unkempt face and wearing tattered clothes.
He didn't find the treasure.
So the moment he sees him, the friend thinks that, okay, probably the guy didn't find the treasure. He was not lucky. So goes up to him and he says, so you didn't find the treasure, isn't it? It's okay, better luck next time, or something like that. So then the poor man says, no, I did find the treasure. So the friend asks him, you found the treasure? He said, exactly, you know, beyond the river in that mountain range, there was a cave, and I found the treasure, and there's, you know, kilos and kilos of gold coins there. So this man says, you found the treasure, then why are you still the way you were a couple of months back? So he says, no, I found the treasure. So now I lead my life, and whenever I feel the problems are too much and I'm, you know, I feel too poor, I go back to that same cave, walk amongst all the treasure, feel very rich and come back.
That is the end of the story.
Right.
Prem, you know, usually when you preface and say, I'm going to say a nonsensical story, it often, I know that it's going to develop into something. But I don't know, Prem, this really feels like some...
Right, this is... I mean, that's the beauty of it. It appears so absurd and stupid, but isn't it exactly what we all are doing?
Meaning?
You know, we all live in our life. You know, we all go through life with a lot of troubles and we don't have peace in life and all that. And then one fine day you say, no, this is becoming too much for me. Let me take a break. Let me recharge my batteries, you say. And you say, we'll go to Prashanti Nilayam. Because what does Swami say? Swami says it's the abode of peace. But what do? We come here. We enjoy the peace, we stay for 2-3 days, we feel very peaceful. And then what is the point in going back to our life and leading it the same way you led it before you came to Prashanti Nilayam? Isn't it similar to going to that cave, seeing all the treasure, feeling rich when you're in the cave, and then come back and lead your poor life?
Without carrying back any of that treasure.
Exactly.
Oh, now the story is no longer nonsensical. Yeah.
Right. And I think this is exactly what Swami is telling us. That the... When, as long as you're going to compartmentalize saying that this is my spiritual time or this is my spiritual pilgrimage point and the rest of it is my life, my worldly life, this is the same absurd mistake we all are going to do. But the fact is, the idea of doing that 10 minutes of concentrated worship or japam or whatever it is so that that peace which you get in that 10 minutes reflects in your everyday life as excellence, as detachment and as whatever, you know, it should reflect as you being a better person, you being a better professional, you being a better student or anything.
You know, somewhere during the discussion, Prem, you said that it's about perspective. How we, spirituality doesn't change anything actually, but the way we look at things, the way we perceive things. For example, if we take my favorite example, that is Gautam Buddha, he was disturbed when he saw sickness, death in the world. After he became the Buddha, what did he change? I mean, there is still sickness, death and misery in the world. But Buddha changed his world. His perspective changed and that made all the difference. That made him the enlightened one. If we take Bhagyasar's example, What has he changed? He continues to teach quantitative methods and production management, even to this day, as an honorary professor in the university. Nothing has changed. But so much, everything has changed because his perspective has changed. He now doesn't think that he is teaching subjects. He feels he is teaching students. And not ordinary students, he is teaching Swami students. And therefore, everything that he does is an offering to Swami, and his work has become worship.
And more than anything, I think it's more than he teaching students at all. For him now, he's doing a sadhana which is in the form of teaching students.
Exactly.
And I think that change in perspective is what spirituality can bring. And when you say that I'm doing it for Swami, that feeling that I'm doing everything for Swami can change everything in your life, the way you lead your life, isn't it?
Really? I mean, I remember the other day when I was walking, came across Padmanabhan, and Mr. Padmanabhan was, somebody was asking him, and he
Mr.
just...
Mr. Padmanabhan, who used to...
I think you should hold on there, Prem, because that's okay, the beauty of the story.
All right.
There was this Mr. Padmanabhan, and he was walking, and somebody came up to him and just asked him, and the conversation was going on, I just overheard, and finally, that person asked, what is it that you do? And Mr. Padmanabhan said, I'm a driver. So the person said, oh, okay, driver, good, nice. But I could make out, you know, from his voice and the way he was saying that, you know, after all a driver, you know, this person is after all a driver. He may be looking good and neat in his white dress, but after all, he's a driver. The next statement that Padmanabhan sir said, he said, by Swami's grace, you know, for so many years I've been driving. And he looked at him and he thought, okay, fine, this person dedicates everything to Swami. And I just couldn't resist. I said, sir, do you know, he's the one who drives Swami's car every day. Oh, you know, you should have seen the transformation in that other person. In an instant, he let go of his slippers. He folded his hands and said, oh, you're Swami's driver. Sai Ram, Sai Ram, Sai Ram. And you know, suddenly there's a lot of devotion, love, every respect. And in a moment, this Mr. Padmanabhan becomes the Padmanabhan. I was just thinking, imagine you go to somebody and ask him, what is he doing? He says, I'm a gardener. Oh, you're a gardener. The next statement, if he says, you know, the Yajur Mandir lawns, I maintain it, and oh, Swami's gardener. Immediately there's respect and regard. It's such an inspiring thought that, you know, what is it that transforms an ordinary kind of feeling into a feeling of inspiration, great reverence and respect? Just the fact that somebody is doing their task for Swami. They are doing it for God. And that gives us an insight as to how we transform our work into worship. If we can do everything for Swami, I feel the same thing, you know, if I go out and say that, you know, I am a radio jockey. Oh, you're a radio jockey. I am Swami's radio jockey for God. Oh, Swami, oh, Radio Sai. I mean, once you get associated with God, can I therefore do my accounts? Can I be a clerk for Swami? Can I be a worker in the factory for Swami? Can I be a sweeper for Swami? Can I be a plumber for Swami? Whatever I do, can I actually do it for Swami, elevating my work into worship and converting my life into a spiritual one, actually not needing any balance between worldly and spiritual, and therefore able to find peace and joy in everything that I do?
Absolutely, you know, one somebody was saying was the difference between respect and self-respect. Respect is the way others look at you. Self-respect is the way you look at yourself. And, you know, for Mr. Padmanabhan, of course, he was Swami's driver. So the respect which others give him was automatic. But when we go through our life, more important than anything else is what respect we give ourselves. And when you constantly say that I am Swami's photographer, I am Swami's radio jockey, or I am Swami's teacher, or whatever it is, the way you look at yourself changes completely. The way you love yourself, the way you respect yourself changes completely. And as Swami says, you know, that is where love for everybody else begins. And I think automatically you'll see everybody else as another person. Maybe he is not aware that he is doing it for Swami, but he still is doing it for Swami, or she still is doing it for Swami.
And when you start leading your life this way, it actually doesn't matter what the other person thinks. Because as you said, once you have self-respect, respect doesn't matter at all. Respect becomes redundant, whether you give or not, because there is self-respect. And that is possibly the reason why Swami said that the beginning of spirituality is built on the foundation of self-confidence. Self-confidence, self-respect, they're all similar things. So, this kind of self-respect, when you do it, you are no longer dependent on your happiness and joy on others giving respect or others giving value, because you know what you are. But the only condition for this over here is the same thing, that one has to be brutally honest and courageous in order to do this. There is no use hoodwinking or cheating in doing for Swami, because you are cheating nobody else but your own self.
And I think that is also the change which happens when you realize that there is no difference between worldly and spiritual life. Because there is no more doing for others' sake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even your worldly external activities, you will start doing
what
it.
What we call as worldly, yes.
Right. You will start doing it only for self-satisfaction and self-confidence and for happiness which comes from within. So dear listeners, we started with what is the best way to balance a spiritual and worldly life. And the answer is, the best way to balance it is to remove that compartmentalization and the difference or distinction between a spiritual and worldly life. And this is what Swami has taught us, and this is what we have all learned from Swami. This is just a reminder about that. So with much love and gratitude, we offer this humble effort of ours at Swami's Lotus Feet.
Hope, dear listeners, that you enjoyed this. We welcome your feedback, your suggestions, your thoughts, your feelings. We welcome them, and though we might not actually present it in the next afternoon satsang, as this is what our listeners have said, they will definitely form part of our psyche. They will be there at the back of our mind, in the bottom of our heart, and whenever it is deemed necessary and fit, it will be part of not only the afternoon satsang but many other programs. Wishing you all a wonderful and joyous birthday week. This is the week that we look forward to in the year. Hope that our love for Swami keeps growing stronger and stronger every passing moment, for that is what will make every passing moment more and more beautiful for us in our lives. As always, we offer this segment at the Lotus Feet of Swami, and here is a song that we leave you with.
Actually, we're going to leave you with a trailer for the Nada Brahmam 9, which is coming up.
Oh wow, that is nice. Yes,
so it's just snippets of the many bhajans which are there as part of that product. We're going to leave you with that, and as always, on the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu.
Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. Shyam Gopala Madhava Mohan Shyam Gopala Raghukula Bhushan Rajiva Nayana Rambanandan Satya Sai Rama Neela Kantha Sada Shiva Jagadisha, Jaya Paramesha, Shiva Shakti Mai Sai Janani, Nityanandamai Sai Janani. Sharanam Pahi Gajananam Sharanam Sharanam Pahi Gajananam Sharanam Sharanam Pahi Gajananam Sharanam Sharanam Pahi Gajananam Sharanam Sharanam Paramadaya
राम है द्वारक में आए द्वारक वासी श्याम है शिरडी